Hey everybody, this is Carlos Azalor, founder and CEO of G2 Esports, former professional gamer and wonderful bodybuilder. And you're watching Dan Ken's channel, Thorin, my man. Enjoy.
Right, this is going to be another episode of Daring Minds. And on this one, we have a guest, because obviously the last few, it was just me and Gio. I will say, viewership still looked great, people enjoying it in the comments, because you know what? The lady doth protest too much, Gio. They always say this every time I do a show, right? Somehow people do this like mad angle on it where it's like, I like, and then they just insert elements they like of the show. It's like, I like everything basically except the guy who conceived, produces, hosts, books, and but I have to be on the show. Like, listen, I understand. You might not like my personality totally, but I am fairly essential.
I like
to the product,
it all
Anna.
But Thorin.
Exactly. Like well, I can't not be here, can I?
I'm the somewhat essential.
No, I know. Listen, don't worry. I've been getting that my whole life. But don't worry. I'll also be sticking around like my life. Well, for now, we'll see. I'll leave that on a cliffhanger. Who knows? Maybe this is the last episode. Maybe I'm just done with myself for today. But speaking of being right on the edge, not knowing if you're ever going to continue on, our guest, Vansilly, here, I've got to actually explain this first segment, G. It's going to be educational for everyone, because what people don't know is Vansilly is actually pretty old school in Counter-Strike. If you don't know, he was doing like world championships. We're talking like 17, 18 years ago, the biggest events in North America. But here's the problem. If you know anything about a Thorin intro, be very wary of the part that's all like praise at the beginning. Because here's the problem, Gio. The reason I have to educate you on that is if you were naively to go, well, he's from CS, isn't he? So I'll just go into Liquipedia, type in Vansilly. You won't even find a page. He doesn't, I don't know how this is possible. He doesn't even have a page on Liquipedia, even though, by the way, because this is the problem, he didn't do loads of CSGO. Like, he wasn't doing like the majors and CSGO. He did actually do a bunch of years of CSGO, but that's why it's actually mad. I don't know what the criteria is that means you're allowed a page or not, because I know a million casters are, nobody's have a page.
It's perpetuating the meme at this point, because I feel like it's such a well-known fact about Vansilly that he's been around for so long.
So mad,
long,
isn't it? I know.
That, like, yeah. They're deliberately doing it.
I almost still seem like that. I tried to be edgy so I could have a Liquipedia page. I went with Yully Noobs and it still didn't work.
Oh, there's the other thing. Do you want to know the maddest detail of all time? Here's what's crazy, right? Vansilly should actually be legendary for a really scandalous moment, but he actually somehow, this is hilarious if you know the people involved, dodged it and it all just splashed onto Dost, who didn't do anything wrong. And Dost tanked all the abuse from the public. And to this day, Gio, we actually talked about this when Dost was on. The public think Dost said the line. What happened was basically there was a player called Smith. He was a legendary French player in CS, actually. But the point is, he was a bit washed at this point in his career and his best years were behind him, right? And the real reason he was able to be in G2, one of the best teams even back then, was because he was best friends with Shox, who was like the best French player and was a really sick player. And because they were best friends, like, he sort of let that guy... It's like, well, listen, this guy wasn't terrible. He just, like, he was obviously one of the reasons they would lose the game, whereas Shox would, like, win you the game, you know? So anyway, over this whole year, everyone, like, I was going ham on this guy. Put it this way, all you need to know is this is how different CSGO is. When we were doing major, I was doing jokes about how, like, this guy was going to get, like, you know, fucking one of those, I can't even remember the name of the test, that test where they put, like, a camera up your ass. I was saying I was going to get his ass torn open.
Colonoscopy?
Yeah, exactly. Like, but we used to go ham on these people.
Like a school test.
No, for real, like, that's exactly the test I meant. So what's mad is, we were going hard on this guy for months, right? But here's what, this is so cringe, but this story's amazing. Then they had an event, right? It was a Northern Arena. Was it Toronto or Montreal? Which one was it, mate? Do you know?
It was in Toronto, yeah. Montreal.
They had a Northern Arena event, right, which was sort of, I would say, it's weird because it was a small LAN, like it wasn't like an ESL or something, but it actually had good prize money, and that's why people like had legit casters and a bunch of good teams went to it, right? And at this tournament, G2 was there and Dust was doing the desk, and he was there, and Vansilly was going to do the game with him, right? And all Dust did was, a fan in the crowd had like a Kappa sign, so yes. Dust got the Kappa sign, and all Dust did, think how tame this joke is, just said Smith's is good and held up the Kappa sign. Like, that's not even an offensive joke, but here's the problem. Because everyone remembers, this is the detail that's so funny, because it's just about timing. What Dust didn't know was, like, I'm not even joking, maybe even that day, like, hours before, Reddit just did one of those things where, like, randomly someone made a thread, like, ah, we've all been going pretty hard on Smiths, but let's all just, like, collectively agree to give him a break or something. And it's like that had just gone up, like, the day of, like, the thing, and, like, everyone was in the comments, like, yeah, we should really like, give him a chance. And Dust didn't know this. So even though Dust actually hasn't done anything wrong with that comment, the problem is, right after that is when they went into the game, and Vansilly did that line where he said, yo, les noobs, because basically, basically, this is, I won't even go into the side part. Basically, Smith's also at this time when people criticize him, did a twit longer where it actually started, "You're Les Noobs," as in he was calling all the fans noobs because he tried to like clap back at everyone. So he did like, so because of that, right? It's even a good reference by Rancini. It's not like he made that up. Like that was a real thing Smith said. So the problem is, because he said, "You're Les Noobs," people got like their wires crossed and they thought Dust said it. And to this day, I'm not even joking, they still say that Dust said it. They still say it's disrespectful. And this is how fucked in the head Dust is. Dust even says publicly, "I have apologized to Smiths for it." And I've told him, "You didn't even do it, Dust! Why would you apologize? That doesn't make any sense." I know. That is so crazy. Because that's, by the way, that for real is how gaslighting works, by the way. If and this might sound mad, but if enough people on the internet tell you you've done something, even if you didn't, you just feel like you did. It. You know what I mean? Because part of your emotions feel like this is unjustified. There must be some reason. So, yeah, oh, he did. He just had his whole reality gaslit. And the baddest thing is, like I say, what's wild is no one ever brings up Vancini. They never even mention that you did send it, mate.
Some recognize the fault, but mostly it's Dust. Mostly it's Dust.
I also didn't even sound like Dust either. You don't even sound like him. That's so ridiculous. I know you have like a really recognizable voice.
I'll set the record straight. Even I DM Smith after that week, after that match, and we were cool. Like it was all fun and games, so it's all good. It's all good. But it was just hilarious how it was blown out of proportion.
Yeah.
I just woke up. I didn't expect to cry laughing to start the show. So
yeah,
thanks
like,
for having me.
You like wipe your tears away.
Yeah. I love a good laugh. I love a good laugh.
Also, by the way, the other reason that is ridiculous, as I tried to stress there, is not only is Dust's comment, like even now it's like it's aged poorly. It's just a totally like, it's not even that bad a joke. It's not even that good a joke, by the way, Dust. Like, it's like a 5 out of 10 joke. What makes that even worse is, as I said, everyone went way harder than that, mate. Like, I'll give you an example. I've even told this story before on a CS podcast. One of the reasons that Shocks actually doesn't like me, I don't really know him that well, is because at one event around this time period, I was stood there with Semler and a bunch of other people, and all these French people were smoking and talking. And then Shocks said something like about like whatever. And then he said something like, "Oh, my wrist is hurting me. It's a little bit tight or something." Because even though he was mega player, he's one of those like really old school ones. He has like RSI or whatever. So I was like, just get Smiths to, you know, just hear him. He's in the team, is he, Mitch? He might as well do something, right? And then obviously, like, Shocks is all like offended by, like, "He is my friend. How can you say that?" Because he's, I didn't know this, but it turns out like French people don't like banter, as we've now established from this whole scenario.
Yeah,
so, like, all I need to know is, like, if they're not liking that, mate, they're not gonna like it when commentators come out. Because there's one thing, let's get into it actually. This is a perfect segue. Because I told Vancilli, basically, we normally don't come in with set topics, but because of his long 10-year casting, not just Counter-Strike, but esports in general, I want to have some thoughts about like how is the Valorant different, what's the scene like, how it's built. And one area I think we could start with is this, actually. The first area, people can go check this, the first area I ever directly interacted with Valorant community was cause of a similar scenario. If you remember, it was the now infamous Liquid Soulcast moment.
I literally
about,
was
like,
about
there
it,
you
yeah.
go. People don't know this. That's the first time I even considered moving into Valorant. And the whole reason why is just because, if you remember, this was one of those moments. It's where, like, Yinsu, if you remember, made some comment when she was hosting VCT. And her comment, by the way, also was tame as fuck. It was just something like because he did bad in the game, like, maybe he'll get caught or something. But she said it in, like, first of all, a totally open-ended way. B, as banter. And then C, she is just the horse. She's there to introduce topics, whether the fucking player likes it or not. She's there for the viewers, you idiot. So anyway, the Soulcast guy basically, like, made himself like a martyr, didn't he? He was acting like, he did like a whole twit longer. Dude, he acted like he had like fucking PTSD from the statement or something, you know. He was putting all stuff about how they shouldn't criticize him. And what was mad was, initially, some fans actually seemed to sort of be vibing with his position. I get that he's the famous player, but some people were sort of like agreeing, because I guess this is more of like a Riot overlapping space. Whereas in CSGO, the reason this is wild to me, Gio, is like, as I say, like, dude, I'm on the majors making jokes about fucking ripping people's arseholes open. Like, you can't then just be going, you can't criticize me, like, in the game. Like, you know. Like,
I find it so weird because at Berlin, I made, like, there was a specific joke that I made that was really targeting Tenz, right? And I don't remember what the exact joke was, but it was something about how, like, his teammates should teach him how to play the game. I don't know, something like that. It got clipped a bunch, and I only know that because around the time after the event, I was, like, going back through VODs because I wanted to, like, get clips to put in my showreel, and then I was getting recommended videos that were just clips of jokes I had made about Tenz, right? Okay. They were like, and they would have like tens of thousands of views, and it'd be some random ass like clip account. It'd be like, "Geo roasts Tenz" or whatever.
All right,
where the fuck is this coming? But like, there were people who were mad about it because at the time still, like, Tenz was still like the golden child of the scene.
Sure,
I don't know if you could really see that anymore. But people weren't mad about it in like a really big way. Like, there wasn't some kind of community, like, like rage or anything over it. And I really felt like I dodged a bullet because I was not very nice to Sentinels at that event because I got really sick of their shit. And so like, I remember I hear about all of these things, like this Soulcast thing that you're describing and this fucking, the Van Silly story that you just told. And I'm like, what God put a shield around me when I was like making these comments?
These are the famous last words, by the way. Now that you've just said that, on a show, I know. Now you've just said that on a show. Because also, I will add this in as well. You might not be aware of this in esports. They only tell you every 4 seconds, but you're also a woman. So like, spoiler, one of these days, that moment is coming for you at some point in time. Because here's the other problem. This is actually a real point to make about commentary and stuff, though. If people don't know, I've noticed this effect happens anyway. In my career, right, when I did commentary early on, it's not that I was disliked. I was just more like in the middle because I was, if people don't know, I actually didn't show much personality. I was a bit of a boring sort of just talk about the analysis element. So I was sort of in a neutral caster, right? But because I wasn't super well loved, I knew at the time, like, this whole game is about people loving to listen to you. They have to listen to you for like 3 hours in a row. Like, you're not going to make it if you're just a fucking neutral guy. Sorry, Dust, I've told you about fucking 50 times, mate. Be an analyst, you idiot. So anyway, what I did is I transitioned to be an analyst because A, you're 2 minute dose, and then B, you also can like do a different personality. Like, I could be the villain then, can't I? I can play a different role. Mm-hmm. But I will say, like, I once heard, and believe it or not, the person who actually told me this principle was Travis Gafford, believe it or not, the notorious Travis Gafford from League of Legends. But he told me being famous in esports is like a rubber band. And his analogy was so good. It doesn't matter how much they love you, Gio. That's just like the band getting pulled out. Eventually, it always snaps back at some point in time. There's always a moment. Like, because the point is, it could even be something just arbitrary. You haven't even done anything big, but just people just get sick of your shit. Like, they get bawdy as a caster. Seems to be like a big deal in esports. Like, have you noticed? Yeah. Even in the modern esports, fans seem to have like this weird novelty cycle they're in where they always want like a new caster that only came up the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like when you're a fan of a player, that's their caster. They just say, that guy should be hired for everything. But what's weird is you can be the same guy and that same fan 3 years later, they're picking someone else to replace you. It's like that's why I find the cycle so different now. It's such a different space.
Yeah,
what's what happened is similar too. Like at some point.
Sure.
Semler leaves for Overwatch League, comes back into CS, is like, oh man, Semler got really, really bored, but he's never really changed anything. He still was a very, very good caster and hasn't really changed his style.
Do you think they did that to you because you were from the old school?
Possibly. I think the good news for me is because I also change games. The thing for me with Counter-Strike or with my casting career as a whole was that I started in, like, I guess I would like to call it the golden era because I'm a fucking old school guy. So like 2002, 2005, talking about all the CPLs, the 1.6s, the Team 3Ds and all that, WSVGs in 2005. Like those were the fun events for me and how I got to travel. But these were never broadcasted events, right?
They were on the internet,
100 listeners. Yes. And then when video came out in like 2006, it cost way too much to run videos. Sure. It was rare to find that footage as well. So I kind of had like a hiatus of like between 2006 and 2011 to try to figure out what I wanted to do. And I started to do more like booth work, live events and stuff like that too. But also those weren't broadcasted from around the world.
You were a booth babe?
I was a booth babe. I was there with the microphone. Yo, come hang out with the booth babes and I, man. We got some World of Warcraft stuff.
Here's the thing.
They actually had to make you wear clothes as well, right? Like back in those days, booth babes could be scantily clad.
I know the way she meant that, though. Like, but I will just confirm for the fans, no one ever had to tell Van Silly to wear clothes, just in case that's taken inappropriately. I know, she meant the other side of that, like, what to put on. Yes, exactly. So, other thing I'd say as well, by the way, as a random aside, even though now we're all big boys in CSGO and all these big games, everyone who worked in CS at some point did jobs like booth babe thing, by the way, because at the end of CS, it was getting super small, esports was fucking falling down.
When were you a booth babe, Duncan?
Luckily, I dodged the bullet on that one, because I was just a fucking nerd doing the interviews, but put it this way, I can name you loads of people. Potter, fucking DeBert. These were all people, by the way, when I would go to some events, like when some of these games were, they would just be at like a booth. You'd be like, oh, why are you on the stage? What the hell? Yeah, exactly, like super legendary players.
Yeah.
Because I went to know that Van Silly.
Sun Men was like with dust off, like the can that was like dusting.
Yeah, the weird sponsors and everything. Yeah, that was the other thing. Because they're at a booth, they're not sponsored with some like normal thing like a mouse you would buy. It's like some headset you'd never buy, but you just go over because it's like, go on then, tell me whatever bollocks this is with this fucking shit headset with a COD player on it. Like, go on, tell me this spiel, like, just because they're your mate or whatever. I want to ask that though, for real though. Do you actually feel like in CSGO you were sort of skipped over a bit? Because like I said, there was a bunch of moments I felt like they were bringing you in because people don't know. They're not actually that many North Americans in like the talent of CSGO. Yes, Gordon, think it's not mainly like Brits and now it's actually Europeans and stuff because we had like Moses and one or two, that was it. There wasn't as many. CS 1.6, it was like, I would say it was majority NA and then it was like some Brits with them. It was the other way around, right?
Right. Correct. So then that's it. So then in 2011, I was like, fuck, I'm getting too old. I got to start paying some bills. So I had to figure out something else outside of esports, because even, let's face it, back then we weren't really making that much money either.
Within, of course, esports, right?
And I think it came down to, like, I think it was 2012, 2013. It was ESEA LAN 14 or 15. I made it to Texas. It was like that iBuyPower versus Titans in the finals. Casted one of those events with Dust and Corey Dunn. Sadokiss, actually Anders was there. And then one of the times I was hanging outside with some of the boys, and I see this dude like just hanging onto the wall, like back to the chest. And he comes up to me. He's like, yo, Vansilla, how's it going, man? Long time no see. I was like, oh, good, man. And I didn't really recognize him because he didn't have hair. He was fucking bald now, and it was actually Jason. So Moses was
So Moses, him returning, you know, right? Okay.
Yeah, so he was starting to try to want to get into casting. Like, he just started playing with Elevate and trying to IGL with that as well. And then suddenly he's like, yeah, I want to maybe try to get into casting. And then I think that's where maybe like a year or so later, he joined Anderson Semler with Room on Fire. And then that trio kind of like blew up, and then that went on forward.
Right.
And I was already doing some, like, a lot of online leagues with ESEA LAN and SIVO, or ESEA League and SIVO League, with Jason, with Sadokiss, with Dust, and all that. And I felt like, at that point, I was like, I really need to start making a more steady cash flow so I could fucking live. So unfortunately, I had to be like, okay, I'll hang up the mic for now, keep it as a hobby, and then find a corporate job. And then I, just within those months, that's when CS and CSGO started to like blow up after like DreamHack 2013.
So you zigged right at the moment you couldn't zag, man. Right? I'll say, okay.
I felt like I've done that so many times.
Oh, right, in other games as well, you mean, right? Yeah, true. Yeah. That's the part I actually never thought about, because obviously I tend to just work in like one game until it's dead, right? I never thought that angle. Like, it must be so tricky to pick the time. What do you think on that, Gio? You've done a bunch of that. How do you pick the time and when to move?
So it's interesting, because for me, the big example would be Overwatch, which was the first like game that I was really in. And
you were on the cusp. You probably would have been established by now if you stayed, right?
So I left Overwatch in 2019 because I was sort of in this weird spot. I always describe it now as like I was too late for the first generation, but too early for the second generation. And I was at a point where like I had only been casting for a short amount of time, but I was growing quite quickly, and I was also getting like offered opportunities that, like, to be honest, I like turned down stuff, like paid work to do like unpaid or poorly paid Overwatch stuff, because I wanted to be in Overwatch. And it sort of got to the point where I was like, it kind of got to the point where I was like, I've shown a lot of dedication to this game, but it is having a serious effect on like just my like mental health to be putting so much into it and still having no idea if it's ever going to work, let alone when. Right.
Sure.
And I really just felt like there's not much of an opportunity for me to like go through the steps that I want to go through, because like I would have to do this thing next and there's no spots on those. And I know personally the people who were on that product and probably aren't going to be leaving anytime soon. And then like Overwatch League only comes like later after you've kind of gone through that. And I was just like, I just don't think it's a good idea anymore. Mm-hmm. Now it's not so much that I think that if I'd have just stayed for a couple more months, it would have worked out or something, but I did have a conversation with someone recently who worked on the Overwatch League at the time and was involved in some of those decision-making processes. And they said to me, like, oh, yeah, you were actually one of the talents.
There you go. This is worse. It's actually worse somehow to find out later, though, because like, it's like that moment in the movie where it changes everything. Now, you know, right?
If I had found that out a lot earlier on, maybe it would have bothered me. But I think I'm far enough along that I'm like fully at peace with the fact that I left. And I'm really grateful for like the things that happened since then. I'm glad that I got to. At the time, the idea of like working other games sounded horrific because I wasn't really like passionate about them in the same way. But in hindsight, I'm like, actually, I've grown so much more as a result of working in more than just the first game that I went into, that I actually see it as an almost necessary. Like, I have have friends I know from other games who've only ever worked in those games. Oh, loads, and I'm I feel hypocritical because I would have hated to have been told this, but I think one of the biggest things you can do for yourself is at least get some experience in another game. Like, so that you can learn more and know more people. Yeah, and there's just so much you gain from it. So I think like when this person told me this, it was just sort of like, oh, I kind of like laughed. It was sort of a weird, like, oh, that's so funny how things could have been. But then I'm like, actually, I think like I've gained so much more from having to almost be forced to go and find new homes since then. And obviously the other thing with that as well is that, okay, while I may have been like flagged for the Overwatch League, like that, knowing the Overwatch League, that probably still could have taken like 4 years.
True.
And
exactly.
So it's like, if I had stayed in Overwatch, it would have been a slog. And, you know, so
want to move to LA. So you just knowing your luck, right? Even if it had taken off, it'd be right when like online shit started. Like, you just stay online now in the UK for 1 year, Gio. Sorry, you're not moving here. Like,
the funny thing is like when I was doing Overwatch when I was doing Overwatch stuff, this was before I decided I wanted to move abroad.
So,
actually, that maybe could have been like something that I would have been like, oh, I don't know. At the time, but I don't think I've ever kind of had that feeling of like, if because then Rainbow Six was the next big game for me, and I, by the time I left, and I put that in quotation marks because that was less to do with me choosing to leave and more that the product I was working on stopped existing. But by the time I left Rainbow Six, I kind of felt like I'd done everything in Rainbow Six. It wasn't so much like I had. Like, the one thing I never got to do in Rainbow Six was any kind of, like, event. Even when I did, I only did, like, one Tier 2 thing in Rainbow Six, but I never even got to work a live event for that. But I was doing Rainbow Six, I was contracted. So the first year I did Rainbow Six was 2020, and I was contracted for 2 majors that year, but it was 2020, so they weren't. So the first one that we did was in a studio in Paris, but then by the time the next one rolled around, like, COVID was pretty bad again, so that was remote. So I like really just avoided all of these opportunities to actually do live events in Rainbow Six, and that's probably my one regret about Rainbow Six, is that I can never say that I got to work a live event in it. But in terms of like actually feeling like I had sort of got to the day-to-day point that I wanted to be in, I don't feel like I, you know, missed out on something in that sense.
You are a little bit like the pro players, though, because to be fair, I hadn't thought of that, because obviously I'm come from the era of talent where we've all done a million events. Like, actually, you basically had like a year and a half robbed of your career as well, because, like, essentially, just like players, that would be LAN experience for you. You're on camera, you're in the studio, you go to the event. Yeah, that's actually meaningful for your career. Vansilly, what do you think on this topic? Because actually, one thing she said there, I'd love to get your take on, is obviously you come from the era where just to make a living, you have to do loads of games. Like, if people don't know, sometimes when you would go to these events, the standard format for esports was very different back then. When you would go to an event, it wasn't just one game. It wasn't like CS. It wasn't just Warcraft or whatever. Usually back then, you'd have events that were at least 2 or 3 games, and some of them, the crazy ones, like World Cyber Games, would have like 10 games, and the joke was half of them no one's played. So like people like Red Eye would be casting like famously like Karom 3D, like some sort of fucked up 3D pool game. And the joke about that is, if people don't know, that just shows you how mega Red Eye is, not the game, because Red Eye would have like never seen that game, but he's just such a good caster. He'd make it sound like he knew what the fuck he was talking about, and he'd be creating like hype about it. So like, look at this angle here, he's going to bloody get in off the bank. Like, and you'd be watching like, he hasn't even watched this game before. Fuck it, he's good. So anyway, that was the era, right, when Vansilly came up in. So one thing I want to know is this, is back in your day, you basically had to change games anyway and do a bunch of games that presumably aren't your first love, right? Because I know that's actually a big topic for talent in general. I would say in the modern day, aside from things like CSGO, people going to Valorant, actually most talent just work in one game. It's the first game that they love, so it's the one that's easiest to get into, and they just pitch their everything to the mast of that game, and they hope that game makes it. And if it does, they make it. And if it doesn't, maybe in 4 years, they're like StarCraft 2 and they've got 2 events a year or something. Who knows? So what do you think, Vansilly? Do you have to love a game to some degree? How do you get into other games? What's your take on that angle?
Yeah, actually, I feel like my love for it kind of like changed over time, because I do agree with you. Like back, but luckily enough for me, World Cyber Games days, I could still stay onto Counter-Strike 1.6 and just cast Counter-Strike. And I was there doing most of the days for TSN or for Radio ITG, just doing Counter-Strike. But as you mentioned, as Red Eye, I had to do like 4 or 5 different games, which is why sometimes when it got to a point where I think the casters are getting paid to do the events or not. There was a lot less casters going, yes, but they were doing a lot more games, right? So I think that's how that kind of changed, and then that's how I started not doing World Cyber Games events. But examples such as CGS, I did like the Pan Am Asian Finals in Malaysia, and I had to run like Dead Alive 4. I think it was Forza, Counter-Strike Source, and then FIFA. And I was like, oh shit, I never fucking played FIFA before.
Yeah, I played FIFA once. And I remember being I don't know football.
Oh, in case you're unaware as well, by the way, when he says Dead or Alive, that is indeed the infamous series, the one where they make the fucking tits have physics to them so they bounce each other. Because that's how pathetic esports was in CGS. They did that as the game. Not like, by the way, the real...
Dead or Alive.
You could have had the real fighting games. Like, obviously, Smash Brothers was in theory around there. Like, there would have been fucking Tekken or whatever. But no, they chose that one because it was that's how cynical they were about putting esports on TV.
But thankfully, it was like also I always had a passion into casting, right? Just trying to be like bring esports into the mainstream, and that was like the dream of a lot of us back then. Still aspiring to that somehow today. So when you're having to switch to different games, it was just normal because it was what was trying to hype up what esports wanted to be. So sometimes you'd go into Painkiller, sometimes you'd go into Call of Duty. And thankfully, it was always games that I actually really loved and enjoyed casting. But the difference is, again, is when you're looking at it from, let's say, the era of CSGO coming out, League of Legends, Twitch, and then CSGO, and now Valorant, is I have to stick to one game. And I think that was probably one of the reasons why I felt like I was left out for CSGO when I was trying to grind that back into the scene. Because, one, I had to make their name for myself again, because nobody knows fucking Vancilly from 2003. Who the fuck are you, right?
The point you made earlier, actually, I hadn't thought of that, but obviously most of your heyday wouldn't even be on YouTube because you used to have streaming back then. Like,
most of the audio files.
You could still find a Team 3D versus SK on Nuke that went triple overtime, then randomly switched over to CPL Mill as the third overtime because there's too many OTs, and I cast it with Midway and Who Man, but that's like one of the small ones, right?
Right.
But the biggest step back then. But just to get back onto that topic, it's like I wanted to make sure that I don't get back into the casting scene by name, because most of the people, and that was a great advice that was given to me as well, is like, if you leave for 2 years, and as you said here, Duncan, if you leave for 2 years or you stay for 2 years, somebody wants to replace you in 2 years, and the fans kind of want to replace you within 2 years. So within 5 years, maybe some of the old school people that got older knows you from back then, but any new kids have no idea who the fuck you are. So I'd rather get back into a scene and grind my way back up so that my work and my craft speaks for itself, rather than just trying to get back in by networking and my name, I guess, in some point. So it's very important for me to really study and stick to one game, right? If I wanted to go into Valorant, for example, like I did now in 2020, is like I have to live and breathe this game because, you know, in a past episode, as you spoke to about it with Dust and Sideshow, is like the meta shifts continuously, and it always changes and changes, almost like League of Legends at some point always changes when there a new champion comes out or there's some tweaks going on onto a hero or a champion that changes the game. And I feel that if I leave for like 2 or 3 months, there's just so much that I'm missing that I can't bounce from like one game to another, especially as like, let's say, a color caster or an analyst, because I feel like I'd already be behind on times. But the rough part about that is that if you only stick to one game and casting, you also will cut down the amount of revenue that comes into you if you're going to say, oh, I could maybe still do Counter-Strike. I maybe have what it takes to do the minimum into like another tier one title, a triple A title for esports, but I'll just be like a jack of all trades, you know? And for me, I always aspire to be like the best caster in the very game that I want to work into, and it's always a game that I love. So naturally, Valorant, very similar to Counter-Strike, but I also think it was an easier way for me to get back into casting, for one, two, for still doing attack FPS, which I love, and then three, it's just like the ecosystem for casters in CSGO is still already like set in stone, that it's I feel it's still very hard to get back into it.
It's hard to crack into for sure, man.
Exactly, because I mean, and even back then, too, like, I think it's very important to really study the game and to know the community, know the strategies, because I was one of those that never really listened to my VODs because I was like, ah, fuck it. I'm doing online leagues for ESEA and SIBO. I'm doing all the big ones. I did CPL and all that shit. I know I'm good enough, you know? And I think that was like an egotistical thing where I was like, you know what? my peers told me nonstop, like, you got to listen to your VODs so that that's the only way you could get better. And I actually started doing that when I got back into Valorant. So late, Duncan.
But I get it, though, because the point is, like you say, you come from a different era. Like, you're essentially from the era, the analogy I would give is, you're like the era when if people wrote, like, a sci-fi novel, you used to get paid, like, 1 cent a word, and you had to just write all day long. Like, in that scenario, you're not going to be rereading all day. Like, you have to just do the writing. But now it's, like, in the modern day, it's like if you were, a, like, J.K. Rowling or something, you could write the book whenever the fuck you want. It's been the best. By the way, you know one thing I want to ask you about, Gio, because I want to get your take on this. Because one thing that is very different about the three people in this call, even though we've all worked on broadcast and done events and stuff, because Vansilli, this is actually an artifact of the era he came up, because he came up in the era, Gio, of audio only, everyone like Vansilli had to have a great casting voice like he does. You had to have that American, like welcome to TSN. This is the to, if you don't have that voice, if you just talk, like, we just talk normally, basically, if you notice, we just have our voices.
Like a transatlantic kind of 40s accent.
No, they all had it, but they were all amazing. Like I always say, for example, even though he's sadly now super forgotten, I actually think that Warwick guy had one of the best voices ever in esports, mate. He had a fucking amazing, like, that. He could have been like a UFC caster or something, mate. So anyway, the point is, I want to know, what do you think about that? Because in the modern day, it doesn't seem like the casters go for the caster voice. They just seem to do their voice. You just turn the volume up 20%, don't you?
I think that it's probably come from this kind of, like, separation of, you know, esports, trying hard to, like, mimic sports broadcasts, and then esports kind of understanding that actually the most marketable way of having, like, broadcasters or anyone who's representing something is to have a somewhat relatability to the audience. That's why audience like streamers, they like co-streaming and stuff like that. And I think that for people to be invested in the broadcast talent, they can't seem like sort of soulless figures. And I think trying too hard to do, like, a broadcast voice, like, as you say, for some people that really is it. Think of Captain Flowers, right? Like, he has a real broadcast voice, and he, but you know that that's just his natural, you know, that's just his inclination, right? And so it doesn't sound forced, doesn't sound fake, but a lot of people don't have that. And I think that it does typically sound better if people kind of just talk to what, you know, their inclination is. I think that there are definitely people that you'll come across at times, probably not at the top tier, but just in general, where you hear them cast or you hear them on broadcast and you're like, their voice doesn't really suit this, or, like, at least in, you know, in my tastes, like, I don't really get on with their voice. But I think the fact that there are so many casters, that's one of the really nice things, is you can kind of figure out what your preference is for how people talk and stuff like that. And there's a lot of variety in that. I mean, the interesting one for me is obviously, and this is kind of from, I suppose, a personal perspective, is, you know, the whole argument over, like, are female voices as nice to listen to? Because I would say, at least, especially in Valorant, people just don't question it now. Like, it's just not, like, female, you can have female casters, you can have an all-female broadcast. Like, on Valorant, you can have female desk hosts with two female analysts.
I mean, you guys did have Pansy from, like, day one almost, didn't you? You had it pretty early
in
that,
like,
game, right?
It's like, there are tons of women in Valorant, and people just don't question it because it's not kind of turned into a big thing. Like, it just sort of is what it is. But I remember when I started casting at the end of 2018, and I was kind of self-conscious because I was like, I fucking hate my voice. Like,
you think it's annoying, like, or
when I was in school, when I was about 12 or 13, I had a teacher who told me how awful my voice was. And ever since then, it has been total bitch. But, like, ever since then, it's been a huge thing. And I tried to actively lower my voice, but I still have a pretty high voice. And I remember thinking, like, I really hope this isn't going to, like, fuck me, because, like, I really want to do this, but I feel like I don't have, like, the same kind of voice that other people do.
I was going to say, that's something that's just very common within casters in general. One, never liking the sound of your own voice, but two, because of, like, these uncertainties, you're always having, like, this sort of, like, imposter syndrome, right? I was like, oh, do I deserve these events? Why am I not getting picked for these events? Am I not that good compared to my peers? Like, same thing. Like, I feel like maybe Dust is in the same kind of boat as well, where him and I were grinding Counter-Strike scene for a very long time in CSGO, and we still weren't getting the big events, but we're doing all the online events and we're trying to work hard, right? And I think that's where it's more like, if you're still getting, the way that I see it and that I cope with it as well, is to say, if you're still doing these events or you've done these high tier events in the past already, you already have what it takes. So you just continue to need to have that confidence so that you can just continue to grind on.
I definitely kind of Yeah, I kind of got to a point where I was like, well, it doesn't really matter what I think of my voice, because I'm not the one who has to sit. You know, it's like...
that's a hell of a conclusion. Okay.
I was like, I'm... I like that. No, but that's kind of it. I was like, I'm delivering a service, but I'm not the one who has to be the recipient for it. So it's kind of like, if, you know, if at least if I'm good enough at what I'm doing and I'm still getting picked up for stuff, then... it doesn't really fucking matter what I think. Yeah, do I like my voice? No, I don't. But it's clearly not a big enough issue that, like, it's going to...
No, we get what you mean. I'm just saying the way you phrased that sounded like... But then I realised I'm not the one fucking listening anyway, so they'd hear me for this shit.
But that's it. That is exactly
on some level,
But it was... I mean, it was something that when I started casting and I was looking back at, like, my VODs and stuff, and I was listening to not only what I was saying, but also the way I was intonating, I did try to, you know, really focus on certain things. Like, for example, you know, I've never been a play-by-play caster, but in a lot of games, you do have to hybrid to a certain extent. And in the very beginning, and I think this is a problem that a lot of women who cast have when they're quite green, is when I was getting louder or getting hype, I was getting higher. Whereas what you should do and what I had to teach myself to do was to drive it from your chest, which is something that Pansy is exceptionally good at. And you drive it from your chest so it becomes like a broader sound rather than a higher sound. Yes. And that was something that I, like, you know, went out of my way to improve at doing, even though it was something that I probably wasn't going to need a lot, because at least back then I was like, I will color cast and do nothing else. You know, the experiences that I have since then have meant that I've had to step out of that. And it also is that my casting now is, I am more comfortable with kind of like, going to that sort of energy level if I need to, because I've taught myself and practiced how to do that. So I think that there are things about it that I did specifically focus on to kind of like not lean into the things that I thought were not nice about my voice. But for the most part, I'm just kind of like, well, my voice is my voice. And no one else gives a fuck. Like, I'm the only person who gives a fuck. I know for some people, that's how they have to think about the way that they look and stuff like that. But for me, it was always like my voice. I'm like, well, like, I've got better things to worry about.
Even as what you're saying, it's like Weezer, you're still getting events. People still love watching you and listen to you. And you're kind of like in your own mind with this. But I think the other point that you brought up, I think that was very interesting is, you know, a community or viewers also like to listen to and watch people that have personalities, which is why they're attached, like, you know, some sort of like on-camera personality as well, which is why, again, for me with an era when I was in audio only, I still had to try to like build that when the camera started, when I started to get on camera, because I was like, I look like I had a resting bitch face the whole fucking time when I was.
Oh my god, the amount of time I've tried to fix, like, okay, when you're not speaking, what muscles do you exactly have to like, you do what in your mouth?
So do you, it's, do you know something sad? I'm literally not exaggerating. That's part of why I actually decided I had to become a villain. Because if people don't know, I have a really terrible one where if I'm just sat, like, if I'm just sat on a train just reading a book, fancy, I'm not doing anything wrong, but just I'm thinking. Like, I not only have the face, but I also get the furrowed brow. So, like, and people will just be like, what's bothering you? Like, nothing, what are you on about? So I would never be able to carry off looking fucking just smack.
For me, this
I couldn't
is
do that all the time.
This is like kind of niche, but like, I have a specific jaw problem. I have a thing called a reverse overjet.
We're getting a lot of information on this episode. I know we're getting a lot of background. Come on, okay.
I have something called a reverse overjet, which means my bottom jaw is bigger than my top jaw. And I was supposed to have like full reconstructive facial surgery over it, which I pissed out of. But it means that like the way my jaw naturally sits is that like it can look like I'm just gurning if I'm like if I'm not careful about like how I look. And like it's gotten better as I've gotten older, but still I'm just sort of like, okay, I need to be really aware of this, because in my really early broadcasts I would just kind of clench my teeth when I wasn't talking, and I'd be like, oh my god, I literally look like I'm in a K-hole or something like that. I need to stop.
Was... Molly or something. Yeah, exactly. you get a bit too... Well, the sad thing is, actually, we already made that joke in CSGO, actually. In CSGO, we did a skit where we had a play. It was Alexi B, who at the time was in OG. And the joke was, he goes to the doctor, and I'm the doctor, and he's like, I'm addicted to Molly, because obviously we call it the Molly dope with the fucking the Molotov, the incendiary grenade. So we even did that joke already in CSGO. Yeah, we already did it, don't worry. Here's the thing I want to ask, though, because the topic you brought up at the beginning, actually, let's go back to that. The one about what do people think about female voices in, let's say, Valorant, TAC, FPS. Because I've got a few takes on this, actually. I think it's actually like a a topic where I think it's a lot of like give and take on it, basically. Like, for example, I definitely know what you mean in the sense that like there are certainly women, and I would even say you're in this category, I would say it's women that have sort of a higher pitch to their voice. I think those are the people who by default are going to get some people who are going to say like, I don't like listening to your voice, basically. Like, I will say
especially
myself.
Especially if you're a play-by-play. That's,
yeah, that, absolutely.
I think that's the hardest role to do if you have a higher voice, which is why, like, and I remember really early in my career, before I even knew who Pansy was, I remember someone at the time being like, oh yeah, there's this like really amazing female play-by-play, she's called Pansy, but part of the reason why her voice suits it so much is because she has a really low voice.
Yes, that's another part, because like, the point you said there, by the way, that advice that you gave, that is great advice, because I would say the main problem people have who have a higher register of voice like that is, as you say, when they get excited, the voice register just goes up and it just becomes screeching. And the problem with that is, that's not even about being a woman, by the way, you could be like a man with like a falsetto voice. And that would fuck you up too. So I would say that's part of it. I would say, by the way, generally, the OP aspect in general in casting is having a deep voice. If you have the really rich, deep voice, I think that's basically what we're talking about with the casting voice, right? It's the silky, smooth radio voice. So I would say, by the way, if people don't know, I think there are men that absolutely this can happen to. Like, I always found, I've said this many times before, and I know these people, so they won't take offence. When people think of legendary Counter-Strike casters, Van City, like Tosspot and Redder, you have to realise part of why you're loving them as much, right, is because you're foreign, so to you, the accent sounds different. To me, they actually sound really nasally. I don't know if no one else has noticed this. They sound like they just speak through their nose. So to me, right, they're all right. Like, they're really talented in terms of what they do. I don't think their voice is the best. I actually think they're people who've, like, essentially, the joke is, they were just so good at the casting, you just sort of mind fuck yourself that their voice is brilliant. We all say, same with D-Man, by the way. People used to say D-Man had an amazing voice. Like, he has an all right voice. Like, the difference is, like Gio said, Captain Flowers has an amazing voice, mate. He has a voice that sounds like it's like a fucking Dolby commercial. These people are just talking through the fucking nose, mate. Like, but they're just good at their job. So I also think that's part of it. You have to acclimatize to anyone. Because I'll give you the analogy, Gio. It's like names in gaming. Every name actually is whack. Let's be real. Like, they all sound whack until you've done something, but if you do something amazing, even the stupidest name sounds sick, then it's like, oh my god, like Zewu, fucking sick. You wouldn't think that if he was the worst player, mate. He'd be a joke, then the name would be a meme. So I think you have to like acclimatize to it too, as well. I think
everything is subjective, is subjective, and you can't do anything about it. You just have to like just roll with the punches and whatever comments come out of it.
And I think that's the thing, is also that understanding, and this is kind of what you were just saying, Duncan, is that something that you know, you don't like about yourself, or, you know, using voice as the example, can actually become like a real USP and like a very iconic thing. It's like,
for sure.
So if we're talking about men who have relatively high voices, and if their casting technique were not as good as it were, then we probably wouldn't see them in the same way. But like a really good example for me would be Kobe. Kobe is typically considered like
League of Legends assist,
like maybe the best color caster in League of Legends. And he has a very unique voice, which, because we know Kobe is really good and he has all of this history and these crazy lines that everyone knows, it's like, oh yes, that's Kobe. Like, that's one of the voices of League of Legends. But if he didn't know how to use his voice properly and were not that great a caster, you probably wouldn't think that, because he doesn't have a really deep voice, you know? And so I think that's an interesting way of thinking about it, is like, you have to understand like how to use the dynamics in your voice. And I think that was something that I was always kind of grateful about when I talk about me sort of recognizing that, like, okay, I needed to not go up in register and I needed to learn to project in a certain way, was that I could watch my own stuff back and recognize that that was the problem. And I always say this to people when they ask me, like, oh, you know, how to like get into casting and stuff. I'm like, I think one of the most valuable skills to be a broadcaster is to be able to recognize things for yourself, whether that's like an actual professional decision you have to make, i.e. like, okay, how am I going to make content that people want to watch? Or if it's things like how to improve, like, okay, you have to be able to watch back your own VODs and be able to actually see what's shit about them. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because, like, I'm a very creative person. I have always been someone who does a lot of art. I make music and stuff like that. And one thing I've always found through the course of my life doing those things is, it's very easy to listen to something that you have made and not hear the difference between that and an actual professional level thing. Because for you, it's like, I put so much work, I know what went into it. And like, to me, I'm like, whoa, I'm proud of this. This is cool.
Okay.
And you can't necessarily like hear or see the issues with it. It's a lot harder to do that.
By the way, just to give you some clarification, though, I will just say, I actually listened to that song that you put on Twitter the other day.
Oh, the other day?
You're an amazing caster. It just made me realize what an amazing caster you are.
Thanks, Doug.
Go on, keep going. Just in case you wonder if I thought it was professional quality. Yeah? It's all right. Yeah.
No, but I think that that's like, it's the same with casting, and you have to be quite ruthless on yourself because you need to be able to recognize like what other, like what, I don't want to say what the correct way of doing things is because that's kind of a bad way of putting it, but like what are good techniques and where you are not implementing them.
Yeah.
And I think that like people who don't grow are usually people who aren't very good at doing that sort of self-criticism and seeing seeing what's missing out.
But no, just to add to that point, I think it's nice that you rewatch your VODs because the good thing is that we talked about the tonalities. Maybe some casters don't have the casting voice or whatnot, but they're still doing these broadcasts because they have some strengths. Like if you have, like, for example, Duncan, you were just mentioned before, maybe a monotone face or a monotone voice, but you're the esports historian, right? You give yourself that knowledge and you're able to bring that onto a broadcast. If I look at, for example, in other analysts today, such as like Pimp or Maui Snake in CSGO, well, these guys are very technical in terms of like, oh yeah, like Zywoo plays this way, rotates this way, and they're getting very analytical from like a player's point of view. And then you have other casters that are very analytical in terms of team strategies, such as like Jason, for example, on top of the history to add on with you. So there are a lot of strong strengths that allows you to get these broadcast events because you work hard at your craft. And why I get back to that topic of one, it's for me, it's very important to stick to one game so that you're able to build that craft even more. And you have to be also careful of to how you want to evolve your personality and your casting, because again, you're very edgy, Duncan, and you permit yourself to do that, and people accept you for that because that's part of who you are.
Made a part of the brand, yeah.
Exactly, a part of your brand on broadcast, a part of your brand on social media in general.
Sure.
I tried a fucking Yoli Noobs, and I got fucking almost ousted by the whole CSGO community. And I was always the type of person that when I was casting, even back in 2012, 2013, I've already been 10 years into the game, but I still find myself very new into casting because I'm still learning of like how to go out with the times or how to evolve with the times, of the Zoomers and the future generations, right? So I thought I had to cast very meme-like and like to catch on to the little things that's going on. Exactly.
Okay.
And to like the forums, the Reddits. Exactly, like, and start bringing that into the broadcast to be like, he said a funny, but he's fucking old, you know? So he's trying to relate. I'm like the fucking meme of with the skateboard on my fucking back. The Steve Buscemi be like, how do you do, fellow gamers, you know?
Sure.
So and then later on, at the same time, it's like, instead of memeing about players, I now start thinking about, okay, I have to put myself into these players' shoes as well to go back into the example of Smith back then or Soulcast now, is to be like, these guys are still aspiring to be a professional player. And sometimes things that we say on camera on the desk, even if we mean it as a joke, some people is going to take that out of left field, exactly why we have like these forum posts, and then suddenly becomes like a negative stigma around the players, and then suddenly maybe that could be one of the causes why they're not picked up by another team, right? Because the other ones that are like the big orgs or the talent management that don't really follow the scene, but that manage like 3 or 4 esports titles, are going to be like, oh, but I heard this about this guy, never really watching VODs or really having real scouters in the esports in itself. So I try to change that tone in how I want to present and talk about the players more into like what they do well, maybe some mistakes here and there, but try to paint it into like what's the overall package though that makes them a good player, and try to bring that out to a broadcast instead, which is why, again, going back to even talent in itself, what's the best that you're able to carry out, keep that up, but start working on the other things so that you could still become continue to be the best in your business.
It's really interesting because, you know, when I started, and for basically all of my career, I've been like really staunch that, like, you know, I do color casting. This is very specifically the role that I want to be doing. And it's not that I have necessarily changed my mind on that, but one thing mm-hmm. that I've realized a lot this year especially is I never ever thought that I would want to be a desk analyst. But when I did Berlin, I would, for me, that event was like, it really cemented in my head what I wanted my on-camera persona to be, because I felt like being very naturally in that event. And I felt like being on the desk was the most conducive for me leaning into that. Because like the way I describe it now, as I say, I'm not a villain. I'm not going to like completely like go off on someone, but I am the anti-hero. Like I'll be a sarcastic.
You like, do like a cheeky angle, right?
I was, more
like
that. Yeah. Yeah. Can I say the word cunt on this broadcast? I'll be a sarcastic cunt. I'll be like cheeky, but also like I don't really take it too far. But that's very like my normal personality anyway. And I really found that being on the desk, like, let me do that the best that I've ever done. And part of that might be because, like, over the course of my career, I've never had one consistent casting partner. So I have worked with people where I have been able to bring that out really well, but it's really dependent. And that was, like, a really interesting thing for me to kind of realize that this role that I'd always seen as, like, the step down from being a color caster was actually maybe a role that now would potentially suit me better just because of where I feel like the strengths of bringing out my persona and therefore my product on a broadcast.
When you're saying you like to be creative, that's one of the things that's the desk's great for. You
well, I think the desk
stuff.
Is very much like a kind of blank slate.
Exactly.
And you can do, as long as you're not boring, you can do a lot of stuff with it.
Oh, yeah.
I really like, I don't know. I just remember coming away from that event and thinking like, wow, I actually really like, I didn't even go in with a preconceived idea of what I was going to try and do with the desk. For me, I was like, I'll accept this desk position in the hope that they offer me a casting position in the future. And I kind of came away from it being like, actually, like I watched back a load of VODs from it recently for the first time since the event. And I was like, usually if I watch back VODs, like, man, this was actually sick. Like, and I'm just sort of like, I would love to do more of that now, even though in the past that's been something that I've been extremely vocal about not being in favor of.
The thing is, though, like, if you don't know, actually, in CS, that is actually the hierarchy. They only used to put you on the desk. In fact, the commentators basically weren't doing the game. They would just be the desk analysts back in the day. Like, if you ever look at the old ones with me and Richard on the desk, the joke is me and Richard were the analysts, and then you would have, like, Semler was not doing the game, so he's the third person. So actually, back then, it was considered something that was just a throwaway thing that you do between the games. And the point was, though, because, like you say, there's a black slate, that's where people like me and the others came in, and we made our own thing, basically, because the cool thing was the fact that it was such a short form, and they didn't have a good idea for it back then. We could sort of just tell them, like, fuck it, we're just going to do whatever we want. And then we did whatever we want and changed the style. By the way, on the point earlier, a couple of things you said that I want to bring out. One thing was the idea that, as you said, it can become a USP, which, if people don't know, unique selling point is what she's talking about, to have an accent. That's an area I think is so misunderstood, it's crazy. Because the one example I'll give is this, right? For some reason, as a country, this is such a weird cultural, like, set of crossed wires. French people, right? Because inside of France itself, supposedly they've got a really like biting culture of making fun of each other if they try to speak English. Like, if you speak English and you're French, supposedly they'll just sort of like make fun of your accent or be like, look, you fucked up the word. And because they're sort of harsh on each other, though, it makes them all like lack confidence to speak internationally, right? So typically what you tend to find is when you would have, like, for example, French-only teams, some of them wouldn't even speak to the rest of us at events. They were all shy. But once they made the international teams and they got girlfriends, they were all fine then talking to everyone, right? So what I learned was this, right? I remember famously, an example of this happening was Law, who does the LEC, if people don't know, she's the interviewer on the LEC. Yep. She does a lot of stuff back in France because she's obviously native French, and she's actually had a long career, 10-year career as a journalist over there. When she does stuff, I once saw her do a tweet that was like that, where she tweeted something like, you know, I'm trying to change my accent, guys. I'm trying to, like, you know, take classes to improve it. And I remember DMing her. I just told her in DMs, like, look, I get early on when you're establishing yourself, people are going to make that the comment every time. It's going to be like, what a weird accent, or like, I didn't understand it all. But I said, what's going to happen is, like any caster, they're going to tune into your voice and your specific, like, way of speaking. It'll become default. And the best thing is, once that happens, as soon as you break through and it's more like they're watching for you more than the other way around, like, oh, who's this? It's more like they like you. I said, it'll actually become a super, like, really memorable aspect that you have this accent. And I even said, and this is the part that's crazy, Gio, what the French don't get is, probably the number one accent people love in the UK for broken English is fucking French accent. It's considered like you've just dipped it in honey, isn't it? It's fucking amazing. So, like, I even said to her, like, are you out of your mind? Like, people are going to fucking love this. Because this segues into the last point I was going
to
make.
She has a very easy-to-listen-to voice.
She has a brilliant one. Yeah. Like, that's what I mean. If you like it, mate, your accent sounds even smoother because you've got that accent now. Like, it lets you sound worse if you're speaking in English. So this is the last thing I'd say. As much as there can be a downside, like, especially early on, I think if you haven't been introduced or you have a high-pitched voice, you can get, like, hated on if you're a woman. I do think, though, that there's also a fucking sweet spot where, I tell you what, as a man, like, if a woman has a really nice voice to listen to, it's one of the best voices you can listen to. Like, I've personally, like, Pansy, as you say, is amazing, one of my favourite casters. I even thought on the desk, I always liked Potter's voice. I thought she had, like, I'll tell you another thing women can have on the casting, actually, that's quite unique. I think if they have a good laugh, it can be really conducive to the environment. By the way, it applies to men, like, Moses has a great laugh, but there's another thing, someone has a
laugh.
I think Potter has a great laugh. She has that, like, silly, like, giggle or whatever. So, like, mate, by the way, there's an underrated aspect. On desks, just put people on who have great laughs. Put Jason, put Potter. Because then if someone like me is there, if I make a joke, it's shit if no one responds. If they laughed, even if my joke's shit, it makes it seem funny. We're all in the mood. We're all just enjoying it, aren't we? You know.
That's it. That's it. I get that, too.
I was just gonna ask, like, on the topic of accents, you hear a lot from British talent who have regional accents that they had to really try and dilute them.
Softened
did you
a bit,
ever
yeah.
have like a similar, because you're obviously from the Northwest.
Yeah,
I mean,
Northeast.
Let's just put it as like a hierarchy. The, you know, the West Midlands is probably going to be the worst, or like a Liverpool kind
basically
of
basically like Peaky Blinders is the worst.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so, but like, you know, I'm kind of lucky accent-wise because I grew up in the Southeast. So I have what international people would consider
totally expect,
a British accent, right? Exactly.
Yes.
But, like, you know, because it's something I'm pretty sure that, like, Sideshow has spoken about before, right?
That he's...
I think that he made an effort to dilute his accent, but also, like, you can just, I'm sure it's just a natural thing that's happened as well.
Yeah, basically.
In different places.
The thing is, if people don't know, Sideshow actually comes from very close to where I came from in the UK. It's why I always say it's weird that me and him are even in esports, because, like, no one from our area. The joke is the only other person I even know in esports is Vince in CSGO. That's it. Like, our entire area of, say, like, 300 miles squared, there's only three people ever. So you can imagine it's not the greatest place. But the thing is, it's like you say, I would say it's more like I unconsciously did it. Because what happened was, I started as an interviewer, remember? So I will say, when I first used to go to events, part of it's not even my fault either. It's also, you have to realize, the first esports events were the first people at the events of first esports events. So the problem is, it wasn't an international community back then. Like, if a guy's coming from Sweden, he knows English, but he hasn't spoken to a German-speaking English, to a Spanish guy speaking English, and to a British guy. So actually, back then, believe it or not, when I first used to go to events, I was the one that people were constantly saying, like, can you repeat that? Even though we're speaking English, I'm like, I'd be like, what? And I'd have like a French guy speaking to a Spanish guy, they're understanding each other in English, and then they turn to me and go, what did he say? And I'd be like, what? And so what I had to find was,
you didn't have the expectation for an English speaker.
That's the problem. At the time, there are no movies that had this voice. Like, the sad thing is, it wasn't even like Game of Thrones wasn't even out. They didn't have any of the regional accents. So yeah, the problem was, people just, like, sometimes they didn't even know I was speaking English. They couldn't initially tune in, and they thought I was speaking like fucking Irish or something. I've had people say, are you Irish? I was like, even if I was, I wouldn't be speaking Gaelic, would I? Like, what the fuck? So anyway, the premise was, I found over time, just because it was as an interview, which is a direct feedback loop, like, you're saying something, you're looking at the other person, listen to what you say. You're already, by the way, as an interviewer, trying to figure out, are they understanding what I'm saying? What should I say next? So essentially, I would just say that process made it very easy. I put in loads of reps doing interviews, and I just found over time, it just softened all the parts of my accent that were, like, tricking people. And eventually it got so that, like, the wild thing is, even though I said that was my early experience, I would say for the last, like, 10 plus years, part of this also is now people know me and know my voice. For the last 10 plus years, I don't know if anyone ever said, like, can you repeat that, which is crazy, because I have to say, I actually do speak ridiculously fast. Like, as a random aside, I won't say the context, but recently I actually participated as a witness in a court case where I had to go on Zoom, right, and they were recording at a deposition, and this is mad, right, because the woman, it's not a joke, kept saying, like, sir, you're gonna have to please slow down, like, I can't type all this out, like, it's like, I was like, look, I speak the way I speak, because the problem is, I went, like, full foreign thoughts mode, like, just doing all points, like, and she's just like, fucking trying to type all that down, because, you know, she has to get, like, the record of it all, didn't she? You can imagine, it was a nightmare back in the day.
Just catching the keywords when she's speaking, Duncan. I heard Soulcast, I heard Red Eyes, some shit like that. Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, do you know the craziest thing, Vansilly? I even used to get haters from America. This is when you know you've succeeded. Haters would say, oh, he's only popular because he's got that British accent. And it's like, if you know the studio, I have the shittest accent in the UK, yeah? Like, my accent is the one.
Charming accent.
No, my accent is the equivalent, Vansilly, to having, like, a redneck accent in America or something. People just assume you're like an idiot, you're poor. You're like,
he's like that's from Appalachia.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's like, and then someone goes, wow, he's got that sick LA accent. Like, what? Like, you know what? It's like that, exactly.
But that's the thing. It gets back to everything's very subjective too, right? Because even when you are, let's say, English speaking, but you're listening to the Spanish casters or you're listening to the Japanese casters or the Korean casters, they're always continuously hyped. They're always very, very
that's
quick.
That's true.
And yeah, when they're passing and everything, and we don't understand really what's going on, but following the action, it's like, holy fuck, this is hype and awesome. But then you would have English casters, and for one of the casters up and coming and has been grinding for a very long time since CSGO 2 until now, and Young is Upmine. And I gave him that feedback too. It's like, oh man, you're casting a little bit too fast in English, but you know what? It's his style because he actually also likes, you know, watching European football, and he's also Brazilian.
So he's Brazilian,
exactly. So right. Listening to the Portuguese cast, that's his style as well. He wants to bring that to English.
And by the way, that advice though is brilliant. I will say, as a general rule, you can also do that. I would say, I would say for accents it's great, but I also say if people ever find that they get worried they're tripping over their words, just try and go 10% slower. The reason I say 10% is because the best thing is no one will notice who's watching. But if you do it, you actually feel like you have way more control.
Speed was one of those things that was one of the first things that I tried to really improve in my casting early on, because I would listen to myself back and I'd be, even though in my head I didn't feel like I was speaking really fast, when I watched back I was like, this is too fast. And the caster that I studied the most to try and learn how to speak slower but still get like a ton of value in what I was saying was Wolf, who at the time was on the Overwatch League but is obviously an LCK caster now. I think he is such a perfect example of a color caster who can speak at a very tempered speed and still tell you so much stuff. Like, there's so much value in everything he says. And I was like, oh my god, I need to learn how to do it like him. And I studied his VODs for so long to try and learn how to speak slower but not feel like I was limiting like what I was actually saying.
And that's one thing that I tell aspiring casters a lot too. In the end, like, even if I told Upmine back then, like, hey, you're maybe casting a little bit fast, tone it down a little bit. But if that's his style, it's his style. And if he wants to continue with that, let him continue with that too. Because in the end too, if you want to aspire to be part of the desk with Vansili, Thorin, and Geo, then you can't really try to always mimic Thorin and try to be continuously edgy, because we already have fucking Thorin.
Yes.
So you kind of have to like build your own style too. So aspire to cast in a certain way and think and steal a couple of pointers from some of the casters that are really good and prominent in the scene, and build your own style too, so that you could have the X caster joining the talent list and not Vansili number 2 or Geo number 3. You know,
that's what's so ridiculous as well. If people don't know, in CSGO, when CSGO began, it wasn't a game that was like all edgy banter. Like, people don't realize I do that because that's my style. I just find that funny. Like, essentially, if people don't know, my style always is just entertain myself, and then I hope enough people like it that there's some overlap, right? If they don't, spoil it, I'll just be doing this to myself with 4 viewers in a fucking broom closet somewhere. So it'll take care of itself, don't worry. But basically, whenever I did that style, the joke is, like he says there, hence why, by the way, Dust in the original story did this. The joke was Geo, just because it became popular, and it was popular in CS, which at the time, obviously as a game, it's more of a shit-talking game than like League of Legends or something, right? Because it became popular, the joke was then everyone thought you had to do it, and other people were trying to like crowbar edgy jokes into their things. And I'd be like, dude, I can barely make this work, and I'm me. Like, you're not me. Yeah. So you stick to your style. Like, I always say,
it feels
like,
uncomfortable as well.
Of course. Yeah.
Agree.
Yeah, but that's why I've got a secret sauce. Do you want to know, like, this is basically like that moment at the end of the Avengers movie, Geo, where they go like, like whatever they say to the Hulk character, he goes like, I'm always mad or whatever, that's his secret. You remember that was like the fucking tagline at the end, right? The joke is why I don't feel uncomfortable when I flame players though, because the secret is this. I did 10 years as a fucking journalist, which, by the way, in esports, at the beginning of esports, you are the shit on the bottom of the shoe when you're a journalist. Like, players, remember, the interview you do isn't going to be viewed by like 100,000 people. Players act like they're doing you a personal favor when they do an interview with you. If you ever ask like a critical question, they'll just blacklist you from interviews. They'll act like a piece of shit to you. They would always act like they were like some diva superstar, like fucking Gloria Estefan, and you're just some like pleb fanboy, like, please, can I have an autograph? That was how they treat you. So here's the thing, when you've been through 10 years of that, Gio, and you know the level of ego the average player has, when you're me, it's like, after that, someone just hands you a megaphone. And he go, ah, well, you know what, boys? I've been waiting 10 years for this motherfucker. You, your shit, you're fucking, you get 28 four times more than you should. I don't care if you don't like that. Exactly. That's our secret. Like, I've always kept that in the back of my mind, that feeling of what it's like to have the fucking guy's boot on you. And it's like, oh, well, now I'm up, aren't I? Now it's going to be fucking the accounting for. Exactly. The revenge plot.
That's amazing.
It's only partly true. Obviously, I'm not that. That's the other thing as well. The secret I've also learned about interviews, by the way, is part of it's the story you tell yourself. Like, we all come up with a really good narrative as to why we did everything. Half of it, we're just living our lives, right? We're just fucking it up every day, just doing whatever. Like you say, just changing your mind every 3 months. We're all doing that. Let's go into some topics, though, because it's actually a Valorant topic that we can segue into neatly, because we were going to talk about this last week, but we just got into too much other stuff with VCT, which is obviously the big, quick than thunder, the lightning, the world, everything's ending, the apocalypse, Shroud has entered fucking professional Valorant. Like, obviously this news has happened, right? Which I have to say, I initially thought, like, were they trolling with this? Like, I thought, like, is it supposed to be a joke? Is it supposed to be that he's going to be, like, you know, like a playing ambassador, or he's just going to play one off? Like, they're implying this is, like, a real move. Here's the problem I have with this move, Vansity. I'll throw it to you first. I want to get your fresh take. The one angle I have on this that I find a bit weird is this, is the part that seems too cynical is you've done it when essentially, like, competitively you were at your worst. So this just looks like you were like, right, well, I can't tomorrow become the best team, but I could get the most viewers tomorrow. But, you know, I almost feel like, because the problem is, like, I'm supposed to treat this like a sports move. Like, they think Shroud's the best player you could put in the Sentinels, right? So what's your take on this move? On any angle you take.
It's a tough one to think if Shroud's going to make the difference actually into Sentinels or not, because as you've mentioned, it's been on a downslope when Shroud started stepping down from competitive CS. He maybe wasn't performing as well as we wanted to in the North American scene or for the teams who were playing in Cloud9 as his last team. But he's always been a prominent attack FPS or just an FPS player and a great streamer at that. But you have to also think that the difference of him playing a brand new game in an FPS, such as, let's say, for example, fucking Call of Duty Warzone just came out, but he's just going to shit on every single kid because everybody's just learning the game. But he's mechanically just going to be that good and that much better than you. So it just looks like he's always going to be like a superstar player going into a new game. Going into Valorant, I feel that there's a little bit of both, because I thought it was a joke as well, especially when it did the interview or the announcement on the Sentinels social media on Twitter. You see him, like, just, it kind of, like, felt like he was out of his comfort zone of, like, how he was acting, holding his luggage. I was like, is it one of those commercials he's just going to do, like,
it's
this
like April 1st or something? Exactly. So,
but you know what? He's putting the time in. He's practicing. He's in the boot camp. But I think I'm still going to have to be a little bit on the edge of, like, not really getting into the copium of Shroud is going to be the difference for Sentinels because of past episodes that you've done with, for example, Sideshow and also Dust. The topic came up of, like, sometimes you just think about organizations just signing a player because they have such a prominent name in Counter-Strike, and you think that's just transferable skills. Shroud hasn't played Counter-Strike competitively in at least five years, six years, seven years, right? So how is that going to transfer competitively into Valorant, where Valorant, yes, in the basis is an attack FPS, but there's still so much to learn, and there's so much intricacies into how you have to build your synergies to get into a role that's going to help your team succeed. Maybe because he's playing a smoke agent where, you know, a Brimstone, you pull out the iPad, you're just going to put the three smokes wherever you want. You don't need to do any lineups. Omen, you don't have to do that many lineups at all. And the flash is very straightforward because it goes through walls and it's a big fucking bust. If you're going to play a Viper, you're just putting a fucking wall across the map. Maybe you have to do a lineup on your orb. But technically, like, the skills that you have to try to learn a new agent or the game as a controller is, in my eyes, a little bit easier than the other roles. Which is why, for example, when Ethan came into Valorant, he started off as Smokes or Sage. When Nitro came into Valorant, he started with Smokes. And then later on, once you get used to the roles a little bit, you get down the line of, like, okay, I can now flex into a different agent. I know the rotations. I know the timings. I know how to use the utilities. I know the lineups. So I think this is, like, at least a great start and a stepping stone for Shroud to get into it and involve. And he even mentioned on his stream is, like, he's 100% committed into Valorant. So either it's with Sentinels or not, I want to know what's part of this partnership program that's really making Trout want to get back into the competitive scene. But is it going to be like the saving grace that Sentinels are going to qualify for champions in this LCQ? I want to go with the memes and say yes, but it's not. I think they're gonna probably be in the middle of the pack, even at the lower end of the eight teams that are currently playing this weekend.
Right. I mean, obviously, it's open-ended. Where are you coming in on the Shrewd topic here, Gio?
Yeah.
Well, my cynical theory was that Sentinels bringing in Shroud would bring enough viewership to Riot's product that it would make Riot want to put them in the partnership program.
I think a lot of people are thinking that. Yeah.
Like, but I think it's one of those things that Sentinels are in a weird place anyway, right? So it's like they know, because this is true for every team, that you go into LCQ, so you don't have like tons of time to just prep for it and whatever. So whoever you bring in, even if they're like an incredible player, is probably not going to be enough to like save the team, right? You need to have a long time with the team for that to really do enough. So how can they get the most value out of bringing someone in? Well, it seems to me like Sentinels are really trying hard to be this like 100 Thieves-esque kind of like organization where they have a lot of brand value, and their value comes from things outside of purely how they perform in the game. And so that will probably make them quite lucrative. You know, I'm sure they already are because of, you know, how they've been so far with people like Shaz and Tenz and stuff. Like, these are huge brand value players. And so bringing in Shroud, it's almost like a hybrid content creator sort of position as well. It adds a lot of value to their brand, and it means that, you know, they can be in a very good business position within this game. And Shroud, if Shroud's interested in getting into Valorant, if he wants to be with an organization who are going to respect and encourage like his content creation stuff as well, and, you know, also like he's a good enough player that they can feasibly actually play in like an official with him, right? Mm-hmm. Like he's an ex Counter-Strike pro. He's known for the fact that he's very good at transferring between games, even just as a streamer and stuff like that. Like, he's probably not a bad choice just for like, okay, yeah, we want someone to be in the team. Like, why not him? Because if not him, it's going to be someone else who's probably a less valuable individual. So yeah. I think that in the position that Sentinels are in that, okay, well, we want someone. How can we get the most out of a someone? Yeah, let's pick up like this insane brand. And worst case scenario, we don't qualify for champions. Best case scenario, we do, and we make a fuck ton of money doing it because we have fucking Shroud. Like, yeah. I just, for me, it's like, it does seem like a meme, and I'm sure it's probably, there are probably some disgruntled people somewhere in the Valorant community who are really like hoping for their shot to be picked up by an org and sure. feel like they've grinded it out. And I'm sure that's frustrating to some people to see that. But I feel like as much as it is a really bizarre thing or has felt really bizarre to a lot of people, it kind of is sort of in a weird way, the best decision that they could have made for, if this were like at the beginning of a year, then I would be like, is it the best decision you could have made? Because you could have picked up like an actual established Valorant player.
So this is also kind of like, it's the last throw some at the wall anyway. Because, it doesn't really matter
because
if it
works. For LCQ, right. I'm like, actually, your alternatives are going to make you less money.
Yeah, exactly. you guys talked about this during the episode, I think, with Josh again, when you were talking about the 100 Thieves roster.
This is the only guy ever who did research and actually watched past episodes to come on the show. Like, fucking hell.
Okay.
Go on then. I know it's ridiculous. He's like referred to it like it's Marvel Comics back in the days. Like, check episode 17 of Spider-Man.
I love your shit. I was watching Slinkies yesterday. I love when you're putting together. Fair enough. NGO, this is a good show. I love these type of like interviews where you get to like deep dive into different things, and like I actually even learned a lot about, for example, how Chet was thinking about the game with FNS.
Oh, sure.
As well, yeah, right? Yeah. There's great actually. Yeah, I'm doing promotion for your team for your
podcast right
now, but to the audience who already watched it.
Exactly, but at the same time, I feel that it's also a very very good show to be able to dig deep into the guests that you have, and you take advantage of those guests to ask the good questions where you have the experts on that very topic that you want to talk about, which is why I have no idea where the fuck I'm here, but it's okay. But yeah, so we were talking about the 100 Thieves where the clock was winding down, you're trying to rebuild, and you only have like 6 months left or whatever. This could be the same scenario where for Sentinels, LCQ's coming up, they have to make a change, but everybody's in jail contract, and you don't really have any free agents. And you don't really want to grind into the tier or look into the tier two scene yet, because yes, you have some teams and players that show promise, but do they have like the necessary grind set to be able to play into like a high octane, a very important match that's going to put a lot of pressure on your shoulders? Can you act around that? Can you actually learn a game fast enough in a sense that you could actually go into the different types of compositions that Sentinels will be pulling out this weekend? And not only so when you think about all of that, it's not only on Shroud, but you have to think about everybody else that they picked up, right? Zelsis is another one too, but it's also Weltus. I don't know if you know Weltus Thorin, but he's been somebody that's been like a stats guy that's been putting a lot of stuff around for VCTs, but just doing on his own account as well for Twitter, where a lot of the stuff that he put out, like graphs of like, hey, you have 100 Thieves that have like the highest pulse plant success rate at like high 80%, high 90%, because they're just so good at planting the spike, which is why strategically they're playing this way. As for example, Ghost Gaming is strategically and the highest percentage, one of the best teams in North America for retakes on pulse plants and stuff like that. So those type of stats, he's been hired to do that type of analytical stuff to support, for example, Raucus in the coaching. And they also added an assistant coach with Danny, who's also a player or used to be a player that also ranked for Sentinels most recently. So there's a lot of factors and a lot of pieces that have been hired most recently into the boot camp to prepare Sentinels into this weekend. And not to go into like the meme of like Sentinels is going to win LCQ, but the reason why they could potentially get far into the LCQ is because of all of these things. And in the past episodes and just in general on Sentinels, we've always been asking for a certain change. Everybody's kind of like sick of seeing tens on Jet, where it's like you have to follow the meta. You want to see a little bit more, you know, the return of Astra, a little bit more Fade, a little bit more Raze. Now Zelsis, who used to play and was known to be a very good KO in version one, has actually a really good Raze too. And in the leaked scrims that came out from tens in like the three rounds that they got on split, you saw Zelsis play a little bit more Raze. You saw tens on a chamber. What does that fit for the rest of the players? You still have Shaz that's going to be a great IGL that could play a flexed initiator. The only question and the biggest question is going to be, what's Dapper going to play, right? Because if you have tens playing as a Sentinel, what can Dapper play? And Dapper could potentially play that Fade or that KO. And why I think he would be good as a KO is that's one of the agents that's the most resemblance into the classic Counter-Strike, where Dapper played for the longest time with E-United or grinding that tier 2 scene in North America in CSGO, is that the flashes will be very beneficial for the self-plays that he wants to do, or how he wants to set up Zelsis, as Zelsis was also a Counter-Strike player, and they worked that ping-pong synergy of trying to trade and set up. So fundamentally, on paper, it looks like a good roster. Now, is it going to be applicable? Do they have enough time with the boot camp to actually have a deep run? Maybe not. But if this is a publicity stunt to get into the partnership program to guarantee something in the long run, they will definitely become a really strong force as a whole.
Yeah, because to me, basically, when I thought about this topic a lot, because basically, I remember when Overwatch, the same thing happened, they made the Overwatch League after they had the open scene, where you had loads of teams. It was teams like the Team Liquids of the world. They were top teams, like, but they didn't get into the Overwatch League, and the players went. So I've thought a lot about Valorant, because I knew in Valorant that they were going to do this halfway house approach. They're not going to a pure franchising league. They're going to essentially, a bit like what we have in CSGO, where in CSGO, it's like you become like a partner of the league, so you just get the invite, but the other team can still qualify through an open qualifier and come through and win the tournament if they were like, I'll give you the example, like an Ascend would be the analogy now, like maybe they wouldn't be in the initial program, but they'd be so good, they or a Paper X or whatever. So basically the problem with this topic is this, is realistically, if you look how they pick the different teams for franchise leagues or these opportunities in the past, there's no set like set of rules. That's why everyone's so uncertain. Like there's basically, as far as I can tell, there's three angles you could get into this like program from. One is competitive, as in right now you have a really good team. Now if you're Sentinels, that used to to be the case. That used to be the main thing that was going to get you in. You were the number one team. You're not anymore, though, right? The next one I would say is like reputation of your org. And what I mean by that is like, are you a tenured org? If you're Cloud Nine or you're like Evil Geniuses, your chances are just way higher, whether or not like Evil Geniuses are purposely picked because they haven't had a great Valorant team, but they're Evil Geniuses. Your chances are also brilliant. And then finally,
they also have an LCS spot. I think that's
that helps. They've also got a connection with Riot as a result.
Because TSM have never been like a particularly high tier Valorant team either, but TSM have.
That's one of the things people are assuming, Well, then finally, the last category is obviously just raw business ability. If you have like the right people backing you, people know you have a lot of money, you could also get in on that angle. The problem I have is this. I actually think if you look at it, this move is actually a good gamble for exactly the reason it might get Sentinels in. Because as I said, Sentinels really were living off the fact that they used to be the original great team and that they have massive streamers. Well, spoiler, if you've ever seen how franchise leagues work, if Sentinels doesn't get picked up, because what a lot of people aren't going to know is, yes, they're paying big salaries, they're not like a giant esports org. If you know the people behind them, they were like involved in like LCS years ago or something. That's about it. Like, they're not like an Evil Geniuses. Then they're definitely not, by the way, some of the Overwatch people who are like fucking Comcast or like some giant sports team at the Philadelphia 76ers. But they're not on that level. So actually, if people don't know, it isn't as obvious. Like, a lot of fans will think it's a lock that Sentinels is. It isn't. I don't think it is. Whereas I do think if you bring this viewership and you also show that, like, look, we can even like attract big people, we're going to spend money on them, I think that does help you get into some degree. Because I do think, actually, if you're Sentinels, the angle a fan won't get is this. If you don't get in, if those players are really living like the pro life and they don't just want to be streamers, they'll just leave and go to the team that's in the program. So actually, even just having these streamers doesn't necessarily guarantee you get in. Because if you know how Overwatch League worked, as soon as they made Overwatch League, everyone had to leave the teams that weren't in anyway to have a career. So it's a lot trickier than people realize. On the actual Shroud point, I found that very interesting, what you said about Vansilly, because the part I actually was confused by is exactly that. When I heard Shroud's coming in, because of the whole rep of Shroud, like, I obviously know him from CSGO, but I know what the rep is. Like, he's just a god fucking aimer. I thought, well, he's obviously coming in to be a duelist then, isn't he? And I was like, what? He's playing a smoke character. Because if you don't know, the thing about Shroud, I won't make a big thing. I'll do a separate video on this topic, actually, because it's time to introduce the Valorant fans to who Shroud is. Mm-hmm. Basically, the problem Shroud had in his whole career that tortured him was that his mechanics were incredible, but actually, as the game evolved, he wasn't really someone in CS who had sort of like a super killer instinct. Like, famously, when he was on Sean Gare's teams, people used to say, him and Skadoodle, like, Sean Gare's had to like micro these guys. He had to sort of tell them, like, right, push up now. Like, oh, can you play a bit more aggressively on this round? The problem with Shroud to me is, he's someone who, in like, I don't get the vibe that, like, inside he thinks he's like Michael Jordan. He just has mega skills, but he's actually like, I know his persona isn't like this on stream, he's actually a pretty humble guy. So the issue I have is, like, I would have thought you just put him in a mechanical role and go, look, we'll do everything else. You just shoot people in the head, basically, because he obviously, by the way, is fabulously talented in that regard. If people don't know, what made the CSGO end of his career really tragic is if you watched him actually play CSGO, you could see his aim was good, but he didn't have like a great game sense. He wasn't. So I even thought as well, you're bringing him into another game, it's not like the most, it's not like we're 10 years into Valorant. Like, he could also frag out in a game like this. He's not going to be great if he's streaming. So, like, I can see sort of why they do the move, but I have to say, I do think it's very cynically tied to, like, it's one last throw of paint against the wall, see what sticks, and then also let's just pump these viewers up and let's send a message to Riot, like, you bring our team in, we'll bring like 200k viewers to your stream. That's a pretty good message to send, by the way. That's a pretty good one, because as I pointed out on past episodes, Gio, the problem you have is, if your team's like a version one, by the way, it doesn't matter if you're like a top three team in NA, you're just not getting in the franchising, mate. Like, you're gonna have to have some special extra reason if you're gonna get in, because the problem is, like you just said there, even teams that haven't really put in the odds, like TSM, they're just waiting to be offered a slot pretty much because of the history. Because the last thing I'll say on franchising is this. I think actually it's going to be very different in Valorant than it was in the games like Overwatch. Because in Overwatch, if people don't know, it seems to me like Bobby Kotick basically gave preferential treatment to non-endemic people that he knew wanted to get into esports, like the Comcasts, like the big sports franchises. So I think in Blizzard specifically actually went away from the Team Liquids and TSMs of the world. Riot obviously has that past connection. So there's another problem if you're Sentinels. You have nothing. You don't even know what LCS is in that regard. You know, that's way outside of your purview. So it's such a tricky scenario for almost everyone. Because if people haven't heard, there are already names like Complexity apparently being like declined. If people don't know, Complexity has loads of money and is partnered with the motherfucking Dallas Cowboys in the NFL. So like, if you're not getting in, I imagine if you are Sentinels, like we used to be good 2 years ago, you are going to be sort of like, I don't know, has anyone got any like final thing we can do to get in? Like, yeah, this is like, it's a good roll of the dice, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Complexity has that money, but they also don't have the players or the tenure of like a good Valorant team.
Your arm's going off, by the way. Well, right? It's time to cast LCK.
I have to go in my room.
You've got a little lullaby going on. I mean, okay, I'll talk anyway.
No, keep going.
I was just... Because Complexity, yeah, it's an interesting one because, yes, they have a lot of money, and actually a lot of the teams use their facility in Dallas as well.
For sure,
but, they... Outside of game changes, I wouldn't even be able to tell you anything about Complexity in Valorant.
Yeah, that's the thing. Grind into Tier 2 scene, they had maybe Ojai in there, they had Calm. I mean, we know Calm as well from Counter-Strike. He's played, with the Flum Pugs for a very long time with Mythic, and now he's actually a pretty good IGL with Team EG. So there's been they've kind of been the scouting team for a lot of the players trying to find the next stepping stone.
But they might also then have a better time in the sort of whatever the name of the tier that's going to be below the.
Yeah, whatever that is.
Franchising is. That might also end up being a better place for them anyway, if that is what their thing is going to be. Obviously, if you're in the partnered part, then you get the revenue share and everything. So there's an incentive to be there. But, it makes me think that they may still get to make a bunch of money by charging these tier one teams to use their goddamn facility, which they're all using anyway.
And also, if they stay in the game, they might just be one of those orgs that farms players and sells them to the fucking franchise.
Yeah.
There's that as well. You can do that too, sure.
Yeah.
So what did you actually think, Gio? I wanted to get your take because he actually tried to obviously do a real analytical breakdown of how the team might play, what they might do, and how they could actually improve the squad. Whereas I have to say, most people just meme on Sentinels. Yeah. So what was your take on Shroud actually for real coming in the game? Obviously, I think if you do it the way he did, I think it's the fairest. What he did is sort of assume that he's not going to be a top player. Who has all the game down the store, but you're just assuming he's going to do he's going to be a role player, right? So how do you
can
this last roll of the dice do it for Sentinels? Because they've obviously got some firepower still.
So one thing I will say is that everything I know about Shroud is from other people because I didn't watch Counter-Strike and I also don't really care about streamers. So I don't know, everyone's oh yeah, Shroud. And I'm yeah, I really don't know very much about him, but I have obviously heard that he is just kind of has this reputation for the fact that he can just pick up a game, play it well. He's an insane mechanical, whatever. So I think that it does make sense to try and put him on the role that is essentially going to be the easiest in the sense of not relying on really intense I don't even necessarily want to say map knowledge, because obviously you would think to be a smoker, you do need to have that, but he can just be told where to put this stuff.
Like, you just memorize the lineups, right?
He can. They can just say okay, Shroud, smoke, connector, and heaven, or whatever, you know. I think that it's kind of what I said earlier, I think if this were at the beginning of a season, yes, you'd probably want to bring in a development player who's a long-term investment. But for something like LCQ, which really is the Hail Mary, then bring in somebody who their baseline mechanics and their abilities are really, really high. And then obviously, there are tons of people you could have picked for that. But the fact that, he's a good business decision. And then also what Van said is a lot of people are contracted up. There aren't any really free agents who sort of fit that bill. I will say I'm very excited about Zelsys as a pickup. I'm a really big fan of Zelsys. And also, I just want to shout out, he finally got verified on Twitter. So the arc has been complete. Okay. It's been a meme for so fucking long. Yeah. But I am a big fan of Zelsys. I really, really liked him on version 1. I definitely really enjoyed the sort of stage 1 2022 version 1 that we saw. And I thought he did a really good job on that team at the time. And Van said, especially on these agents like KO, I think he did a really good job. So I'm actually very excited for him because I think that Zelsys is a really smart player, as well as obviously he's a good player, but he's a very smart player. And I think having some more I've always thought that what Sentinels need more of is structure and to be a bit less wishy-washy in their decision making. And I think that anyone who can come in and is just very smart in a more structural way will probably pay dividends to the team. I don't know if I'm not expecting Sentinels to qualify for Champions, but it would be nice to see Sentinels show some glimpses of what could come from this sort of new era. That's what I would really like to see. I've given Sentinels a lot of shit for a long time at this point, because I think that they have some great ingredients and a shit recipe is basically what like Sentinels has been for about the last 10 months. And yeah, so anything that can really like provide that more like structural benefit. Now, do I think that Shroud is a part of that? Probably not, because Shroud is going to have to be told what to do. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just about whether the telling what to do is clear and really like robust, which is something that it hasn't really been in the Sentinels' MO for, you know, up until this point.
Yeah, and to get back to it, in a short term, I think if you're trying to do plug and play with the current roster, I still think it looks pretty decent, because I think one thing that stood out for me in Masters 2 in Copenhagen is the amount of clutches that we had from players at that event were all Smokes players too. So if you're going to think about the main gist of like the first 30 seconds, 45 seconds of the round where everybody's going to use most of their utility without counting the replenishable utility, then technically when it comes down to Shroud into a clutch position, if he has to play an Omen, there's maybe not going to be that much utility left on a 1v1, on a 1v2, or a 2v2. So when it comes down to mechanically just going back to the sheer jiggle peek, crosshair placement, and shoot, I think Shroud will be able to do that perfectly. Nate, if you think about a lot of the guests that you had through and you wanted to ask them what's the best type of pickup you want to have for a player for a team, everybody said you can't have a player that's pigeonholed into one single role. And which is why, again, to get back onto Zelsys is a great pickup, because he can play duelist, he can play a flex. Dapper now switching away from a Sentinels to play a flex agent, because you're putting tens on a Sentinel that's basically a fucking AWPer and a duelist for the team right now in Chamber, technically. That's what it should be on paper. But you already see right now within the PBE servers and potentially in later patches, Chamber is going to get a nerf. So if Chamber is going to get a nerf and you lose value into using a Chamber, then tens could go back potentially into a different duelist role, and that could put Dapper back into a Sentinel role where they want to bring a Cypher back into the mix, right? So you look at now this roster that has players outside of thinking about these guys, the memes of these guys don't practice, just stream all the time, to think about the history that they had on different agents that they played and different roles from the agents that they played. It looks like a team that could evolve with the metas later on, which is why I still find that, you know,
he still believes. He still.
I still
copium.
Believe. I still
there's
believe.
A lot of copium
I,
and hopium.
I don't want to have to be like copium, but like it makes sense on fucking paper, Duncan.
One thing that you just said that I'd like to build on. So in Valorant, I mean, it's not unique to Valorant, but we've seen this kind of idea that, like, especially at events, there will be a team who plays a certain idea or type of comp or playstyle or whatever it is well, and then other teams follow up. So, for example, Cloud9 at Champions really popularized KO, which then defined, or this specific way of playing KO, which then defined Stage 1. Optic started popularizing this Neon idea, which really defined Stage 2. Now, one thing that I'm curious about that could play into sort of the Sentinels' comfort zone. FPX won Breeze on an old composition that had Cypher and Jett in it, right? And I know that's just one map, but that, like, Paper Rex really lent into this, like, Fade, Breach, Neon, like using this kind of current idea of different agents we might use. Now, they did it in a sort of kind of whack way, like putting them all together, but it was still a very like, okay, this is of the times. Whereas FPX went back to a slightly older idea and it worked really well. And I think the one thing in gaming that becomes very, it oftentimes happens is that as metas evolve, everyone's trying to look for the next thing to outdo a meta. And then don't always consider the fact that going back a few steps may be that answer, right? And that's something that FPX kind of showed. Now, that's not necessarily to say that just based off of this one map and this one idea that Sentinels are going to run away with that. But I think it's kind of given this sort of idea that's like, oh, shit, yeah, like that is a thing we could do. And if Sentinels do decide to lean into those kinds of ideas, that is literally like Sentinels level compositions that they were always really good at. And you do have those agents that you're talking about right now that sort of fit their classic style.
Yeah, but you've mentioned it as well, Gio, when you were talking about Sentinels in the past, too, in a previous episode. I'm going to bring that again. Guys, make sure you watch the other episodes, because there's some meat you could catch from all these episodes and get a lot from all these shows. But you're also mentioning at some point where when you had the Astronerf, right, it was supposed to be a playstyle that was going to fit Sentinels well, but it didn't. And everybody was pretty much, even to this day, harping on Sentinels to be like, fuck, they got to switch something, man. Stop fucking playing a fucking Jet. Stop playing a fucking Sova on Shazam, and we need some sort of changes. And I feel that now, and okay, the first part was like, we need some compositional changes. Then they're stubborn and they're not going to change it, so they're like, oh fuck, well, they need a fucking coach. They brought in Rockus and they were still not finding success. And now it's like, oh fuck, they're not boot camping. Well, now they're fucking boot camping. And then if they don't get a success, what's the next excuse? So I think at this point, now they're killing two birds with one stone. One, having a fucking boot camp spot. And two, being able to potentially change their compositions to keep up with the times in that sense, but could still revert back into the fundamentals that we know that Sentinels are good at, into like their stubbornness of not changing those comps. So yes, I agree with you. Chet's also under that same mind, is that you always have to be ahead of the curve. But at some point, even Energy during stage two wanted to be ahead of the curve when they brought a Neon on Bind and got fucking thrashed on that, trying to do what DRX were doing back in Korea. And then it's like, okay, well, it doesn't work. Let's go back into what's the tried and true, which is for Optic, same thing. They went triple initiator. They tried different comps on Haven. Then going into Masters, they went back into the tried and true of keeping a Neon on Fracture, keeping a Neon on Haven. But if you look at the results at Masters 2, those guys actually got owned on Fracture when they defined the meta of Neon on Fracture.
Yep.
You're playing, and Chet was mentioning it as you were asking the question, Thor, he was saying, like, we are the type of team that could actually anti-strat very well against our opponents if we have tape. So if you're going to spend a lot of your time anti-stratting your opponents on their own map, because that means that you're very comfortable on your very map still. So if you're going to stay back into what you're comfortable with as to playing that same composition on Haven and the same composition on Fracture, well, guess what? Because you've coined and you've changed that meta, there's going to be, everybody calls it the Optic comp on Fracture, literally. So everybody's going to be studying how to play the Neon on Fracture. So you'll now understand the weaknesses of that comp too and be able to exploit that, which is, again, why Paper X and even FPX fucking owned Optic on those maps as well. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword, where to get back at it as well, Valorant has been very fun to like learn, because it's just like there's so many like pros and cons to everything you want to try to bring out into the game, and it's so hard to find consistency as an organization or as a team to just find that continuous success. I think it's going to take us a fairly long time before we find an Astralis era in Valorant still in the first years of this game.
Well, especially in light of what happened to the fucking ex-Gambit squad. So sadly, they might have just cancelled that potential Astralis era in Valorant. But the thing I would say is this. The one problem I have with the Valorant topic when it comes to Sentinels is the other reason I hate super teams that fail is because they just lock up all that talent. Like at this point in time, either Sentinels has to become literally the best team in the world, or I'd rather they just broke the team up. Like the joke is, you could take almost every player and make some other team better. Like you tell me you couldn't put Dapper in another team and then Shazam in a team. And then, of course you could. The joke is you could actually make the whole NA scene fucking god tier with these guys, but instead, at the moment, they're just wasting the last year and a half playing with each other, just fucking having making all this money but never winning any bloody games.
Like,
are we talking about Sentinels here, or are we talking about DRX in Korea?
I would love to see Tens play in a team with a really like stringent IGL, like with some like a real like strict IGL, because I think that a lot of the problems that you see with the way that Tens has played, at least this year, has been based on like, I mean, I've complained about it before, but a lot of like early engagements that are not sufficiently supported, and therefore he dies early. And then a lot of people look at him and they go, Tenz is washed up, he can't shoot. And it's like, no, Tenz is just like going in at a time where his team aren't there for him. Now, I don't know if that is entirely Tenz's fault or if it's entirely the calls on the team or if it's somewhere in the middle. But the point is I feel like with really robust IGLing, Tenz wouldn't be doing those things, and he would be actually set up in situations where he can exploit with the actual skill he has. And I would just love to see that. I just want to see him, like, even just for a week, just put sub him into some team that has like an insane IGL and see how that goes.
Well, that's also the frustrating part about this topic, though, because if we're being real, the obvious, simplest solution to this was the other way around. It was just bring a real fucking in-game leader into this team. You know what I mean? Like, I'll even tie this back in. Yeah. That's even what bombed me out about this move. I actually thought initially when they added Zelsys, well, if you remember, at one point he was like IGLing in Virgil 1. Yep. I thought maybe they're bringing him in for that. It's like, and then they expressly, we're not doing that. Like, of course not. Well, why would you be sent those? My bad. Fucking hell. These guys just don't get it, do they? The memos never got through.
There are a lot of comps or teams right now within Valorant that has almost like a secondary voice. Not necessarily taking the main IGL role, but being good as a secondary voice. And we see that a lot in these teams now. So maybe that could be one of the things where now Shazam could focus on one portion of the map and then Zelsys could focus on helping the other portion of the map. And we'll have to look at the game today, for example, because as we're recording this today, it's going to be the Guard versus Sentinels. But will Shazam and Zelsys, for example, play in different parts of the map on the attack side so they could communicate that a little bit better? But I feel that, you know, Shazam also took the IGL role, but inspired it a lot during his tenure with Misfits with Sean Garris, right? So I think there's a little bit of that Sean Garris IGLing that probably made Shazam wanted to get into IGLing and probably brings a little bit of that style in. If Sean Garris was very micromanagey, I'm assuming now in the comms within Sentinels, Shazam would be very similar as well. And I just find that maybe it's just a style of calling where you're putting a lot of responsibilities onto Tens, just like FNS is putting a lot of responsibilities onto Ye for trying to pick up first bloods, especially now on like a chamber position on defense. There's still an opportunity where Tens could actually pop off on a lot of multi-kills in the defender halves and then just let the rest of the team do the rest of the job. And when you're looking at the stats of what Ye's bringing into the team for Optic, I think he was like 80% of like the rounds that they convert on 5v4 is due to Ye getting first blood within the round. So very similar to Ye in that style, Tens in that style, but Tens has to like try to like charge in because he's playing a jet for so many times. So we'll see if positional opping for Tens could be the solution for Sentinels as well to get more of that success independency for Tens while using the utility of the rest of the roster somewhere else where you don't have to set up Tens anymore, right? We were always bitching of like, why is Kempeki or Sick not setting up Tens for these kills? It's because they're able to put Tens on solo plays because he could actually drop 40 kills in a fucking game without the support and still help Sentinels win games. Now they could do that, but really put him in a position where we don't need to set him up. He's just going to post up like a Skadoodle style op and then TP away if he misses a shot or hits a shot, you know, and we'll see how that's going to change the play style of Sentinels.
To me, I actually think Sentinels is one of those teams where it's like a classic trope in esports when you make super teams. The worst thing about having super teams that have all these stars in is because they're stars, they can play to the skill level they have, the aim, right? What that means, though, as a result, is you can essentially brute force things in a tactical game because you have like the raw firepower. And obviously, that's only become diminishing over the years. Like players have caught up. When they had the original Sentinels, they were like the monsters that was like an all-star team. So in that scenario, you're going to be thinking things are working. Like, I'm doing this correct strat. It's like, you're not even executing the strat, right? You just shot three people in the head. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we say this in Counter-Strike, there's plenty of times that teams win and fans are like, why won't you give them credit for being tactically good? You're like, bro, this one guy's just shooting everyone in the head. Like, that's the neutralizer. You don't need tactics when that works. But the problem is, if you ever meet them time, whether it's a meta switch, an agent comes out, if you ever get to a point where you have to now play just off, like, tactical understanding, execute, it's going to be hard for you. You've basically been playing the game in, like, a different mode, sort of. And as you see, the difference was Valorant, the game has changed, hasn't it? Everyone's acting like it's just Sentinels has changed. The game itself's totally different from like 2 years ago. And like all the teams are different. Everyone's changed the lineups. Like the joke now is if the old rep of Sentinels was like, it's the all-star team. Like, dude, isn't the Optic team about as skilled as Sentinels now? Like, they're fucking pretty good too, mate. They've got some pretty good players. You know what I mean? Like, that narrative's sort of a bit older, Sentinels, I feel. That's why, by the way, to bring it back, I think it is a smart move to go out with one last bang in this LCQ. Like, basically go for broke, try and be a big qualify and see the got some future. If not, then I've quite frankly feel like Sentinels, it's like shit or get off the pot time. You've got to either go big or just change the team, haven't you?
Oh yeah, and they're gonna go big.
That's going to be the move, that's it. By the way, that's one thing I do like about Sentinels, though. They are very American in that sense. It is just the approach of like, we're just going to fucking go ham, just go fully out for it, and if we fail, we're going to fail spectacularly.
American sports movie about Sentinels.
They fucking
you could make an amazing one.
they embraced the marketing, they embraced everything about streamer team and stuff like that. The content that's been pumping out for the past few weeks have been fucking hilarious. They just got a fucking billboard in LA, for God's sake, saying that they're going to win LPQ. So
hey, no, it's still not as good as when Carlos got the fuck sent to his plane.
I was literally about to say, it's almost like a G2 style marketing
ploy. Yeah, you know?
Even look at Carlos. Like, he doesn't have the best teams in the fucking games that he's in. and like,
here's the joke for you. Right? Are you ready? Yeah. Do you want to know how you know Sentinels isn't that good anymore? Because people only ever talk about them with the past tens.
That was shit, but like...
I love it.
I intentionally set up to be shit, though, didn't I? Like, I made it clear. Obviously, it wasn't good. I know. Don't worry about it. Exactly.
Those are my puns. I mean, I'm there fucking old fuck, man. I'm 38 now. You know?
It's the dad joke, exactly. This video was supported by Kill Your Inner Loser, Travis Goff, Ahmed Haju, Matt Pugnaccio Rakula, Hades, Animosity, Joseph Ginsburg, Tobias Bernasconi, Butt Pounder 420, Jensen Gore, Kovacevich, Piercy, Tosh, Adam Ox, Toucan, and a special thanks always goes out to Jerky's Minion. Would you like to suggest a topic or a guest for my content? You want to ask me a question at one of my monthly AMAs? Do you want teasers, find out who the upcoming guests are? Or maybe you want to take part in one of those lengthy esports discussions with moi? Well, if so, put your money where your mouth is. Join the Scrilluminati today via the Patreon link in the description box below.